Well, I have nothing to disclose either. I'll just get right to it. My name is Kelly Gonzalez, and I'm here today to talk with you about research I did on examining perceived discrimination among American Indian women within the Indian healthcare system. Doctors Gonzalez and Warren have described some important social determinants that are unique to American Indian populations and suggest these are fundamental factors that have profound negative impact on our health status and disparities. I'd like to share with you a little bit more focused determinant of health by focusing on healthcare factors. And I'll dive a little bit into our history. Some of it overlaps with what was already discussed, but I think it provides a great context and background to understand how American Indians may perceive discrimination within their healthcare system, particularly within encounters they have with their medical care provider. So a quick definition on discrimination. Discrimination is defined as the differential and negative treatment of individuals because of their membership in a particular demographic group. Generally, such discrimination is based on race, class, sex. A large body of research shows that discrimination is important to the health of racial and ethnic populations. Recent studies show some populations actually perceive discrimination within their healthcare encounters or healthcare experiences, including their encounters with their medical care providers. And such perceptions appear to be true for American Indians. Currently, though, there's limited information to understand the extent American Indians perceive such discrimination, in addition to the reasons that may perpetuate these ideas. Bolstering this body of research, in 2001, the Institute of Medicine produced a report on risk factors for racial and ethnic health disparities. The report was intended to examine less well-known factors for these disparities, emphasizing on features within healthcare systems. In their report, they conclude that discrimination within healthcare systems exists, including providers' bias and stereotyping, which may cultivate patients to disengage from their healthcare system and healthcare processes, which thereby may lead to negative health conditions for individuals. And of the 100 documents reviewed by the Institute of Medicine, less than 1% included American Indians in their sample. As you can see from this model, sort of reiterating what I just said, the point of patient-provider encounter is really important to the healthcare processes. Both the provider brings attitudes, whether they're implicit or explicit, about their patient. And these attitudes may be reinforced by other factors within the healthcare systems, including underfunded services, limited resources, to actually spend the needed time with their patients to get to know their patients. In addition, patients come to that clinical encounter, and they may have ideas and attitudes and preconceived ideas about what to expect in that clinical care encounter. As you can see in this model, and based on the prior body of work that I cited, I propose to you that the foundations in which healthcare provisions are based for American Indians is yet another unique social determinant that permeates through time and today serves as a powerful influence on the quality of the patient and provider encounter and subsequent healthcare processes. So building on what Dr. Warren and Gonzalez have already discussed, I'd like to take a brief look at our history again about factors within our history that may influence perceptions among American Indians regarding discriminatory treatment in their clinical encounter. Since the early 19th century, the federal government has provided health care to American Indians, both as a treaty obligation and as a consequence of its role as trustee. Care was provided by military doctors in 1849, when the Bureau of Indian Affairs was transferred from the War Department to the newly created Department of Interior. Realize, the origins of the healthcare for Native people was a byproduct of the doctrine of conquest, used by the federal government to manipulate Indian people out of their lands in exchange for healthcare. Historians document that the first efforts to provide healthcare to American Indians was second to the need to protect U.S. soldiers and non-Indians living in nearby communities. So the motivation at that time was not to provide Indian care to Indians for the betterment of Indians, but it was to protect the U.S. soldier and non-Indians living in nearby areas so that they wouldn't contract diseases that were so prevalent in American Indian populations. Historical accounts on the quality of health care of American Indians at that time are stated as deplorable. Combined with these early deplorable medical provisions for American Indians' health care, the federal government has also practiced policies of assimilating the American Indian through boarding schools, outlawing of traditional ceremony, medicine, language, as well as blatant medical mistreatment. Some of these violations actually happened not too far in our past. So in the 1950s, the healthcare was transferred over to the Indian Health Service, and which is an agency within the federal government, which has this legacy. And it's important to note that there have been incredible improvements in our health status since the establishment of the Indian Health Service. And although we've had these incredible improvements, we still have massive disparities. As hard as it is, there are true violations that also deserve recognition that happened in our past by the federal government, that have resulted in deeply rooted mistrust for the federal government that persists today and likely shape our healthcare experiences in profound ways and perhaps manifest as perceived experiences of discrimination. Adding to the complexity, today there are great disparities not only in our health, but within the workforce of the Indian Health Service. There's real limited diversity of healthcare providers working within Indian Health Service, and few of the doctors working within IHS are American Indian. So in an effort to better understand the role of perceived discrimination in healthcare for American Indians, I want to share with you a study that we conducted, me and my colleagues, to look at perceived discrimination in healthcare among Northwest American Indian women. These women have type 2 diabetes and receive their primary medical care through reservation-based Indian healthcare systems. There were four reservation-based Indian healthcare facilities included in the study from Oregon and Washington. And we were able to use the medical records from these facilities to generate a cohort of American Indian women that met our eligibility criteria. And at the completion of data collection, 200 women completed our survey. We used a multi-item measure to assess perceived discrimination in medical care encounters based on race. This measure hadn't been applied in an American Indian sample or population before. And I do want to mention that it had high internal reliability, so it was a good measure for our sample. Our findings showed that 2/3 of American Indian women in our sample perceived experiences of discrimination during their encounters with their medical care provider because of race. As shown, our estimated prevalence, the largest bar, it greatly exceeds other published estimates of perceived discrimination in healthcare for American Indians. And our difference in estimates here might be due to the fact that we used a multi-item scale to assess the experience versus these published studies that use single-item scales, so a single question. But I also want to mention that the way we collected our data was through community-based, sort of like an open house. I went to the community and set up shop for 3 days, and women came in and took the survey, and it was quite profound, the experience, not only for me, but I believe this to be true for them as well. Some of the women would come in sort of standoffish, and then they would take the survey, and then they'd be there for, I don't know, an hour wanting to tell their story. So I really truly believe that this study really struck a chord with the women in the study. In addition to race, 44% of the women also indicated that income and weight as the most common reason for the discrimination. We also found that, and these two items I'm going to talk about right now are based on our pilot study, our pilot testing feedback. So we included these items in our survey because they continuously came up as reasons for discrimination or unfair treatment in healthcare. We found that personal or a family member's use or current use or prior use of alcohol or drugs was also a primary reason for the discrimination. 83% of the women with perceived discrimination reported their health-seeking behaviors were negatively affected. So for example, about two-thirds of the women reporting postponing needed care because of such discrimination. We also found a monotonic trend where the number of negative health-seeking behaviors significantly increased as the mean estimate of perceived discrimination increased. So for example, you can see with the highest bar, the women with the highest amount of perceived discrimination reported, on average, reported 4.6 health-seeking behaviors, negative health-seeking behaviors, excuse me. Next, we looked at how such discrimination may influence American Indians' use of standard diabetes services for optimum diabetes control and cancer prevention services. As shown, the women reporting perceived discrimination had a significantly increased odds of not being up to date on clinical breast exam, PAP testing, and mammography testing, and the women reporting perceived discrimination also had a 49% increased odds of receiving fewer standard diabetes services needed for diabetes control compared to the women who reported no discrimination. Finally, the women who reported discrimination in their health care had a 34% increased likelihood of a mean glucose level that exceeded the levels or the cutoff points for diabetes control. So to wrap up, I just want to mention that to wrap up my presentation here, perceived discrimination appears to be relevant in American Indian healthcare experiences and may have an important role on American Indian healthcare processes, including patients' healthcare decisions, use of prevention services, as well as health status. But based on our legacy of healthcare provisions, such discrimination may particularly be important within the Indian healthcare system. And more research is needed to explore this further. In addition, what else is needed? We need to better understand the provider's role in this clinical encounter and the complexities that the provider brings, whether the provider has implicit or explicit bias or stereotyping regarding their Native patients, how features within the healthcare system, like underfunding and under-resourced services, promote provider bias and add to the complexity of these encounters. We need to learn which interventions will work within the Indian Health Service to mitigate some of the negative patient-provider encounters. And we also need to educate healthcare providers as well as tribal leaders that racial and ethnic health disparities and the pervasive health disparities within Native populations may be influenced by provider bias despite providers' best intentions, but also by perceived discrimination among American Indians within their healthcare experiences. So that's it for me. We hope that this panel presentation informs you and serves you well and helps you understand some of the unique social determinants for American Indian health disparities and generates not only dialogue but action. An important challenge we face today as public health leaders is how do we address these deeply rooted social determinants that shape racial and ethnic health disparities? Many of these determinants, as the ones you've seen today in our panel discussion for American Indians, are based on a history of colonialism. And it's unfortunate, but this is the foundation of our history, and it has pervasive impact on our health. This is our history as Native people, but I also propose to you that as U.S. citizens, this is your history as well. So thank you so much for your time. You all got up early to get here, and we would be happy to answer your question.
You have moderators.
Oh, okay. So, hi.
Take the first stab at that. Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay, good. In looking at urban Indian healthcare, there actually is a legal basis for that in the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act, which was passed in 1976. That's Public Law 94-437. And the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act did several things, including starting the IHS scholarships. So the IHS scholarships are called the 437 scholarships. So just like 638 is a verb, 437 is an adjective in Indian country. But the other thing, Title V of the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act started the Urban Indian Health Centers, and there's 34 of them around the nation. And that's in response to the recognition that there was a federal Indian policy period in which people were told to assimilate and relocate. There were relocation programs from the reservations to cities. So in response to that, they did develop some Urban Indian Health Centers. Currently, the urban Indian health centers receive about 1% of the IHS budget, just remarkably low. And I did work with the urban Indian program in Phoenix, and there's a number of challenges that we faced there, including underfunding, but also issues related to a lot of misunderstanding like you're talking about. And I would just put forth that it's in legal doctrine that we have a right to health care, and just like any American would consider the U.S. Constitution a sacred document, our treaties are just as sacred to us. And in truth, the U.S. Constitution is older, so we have newer law in our favor. And again, if people don't want to fund any health service, then they'll say, okay, the option is give us our land back, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. So it's basically an obligation of the federal government that most people just aren't aware of. I think one of our biggest problems historically is anonymity, that people don't understand Indian health issues, especially in the East, because there's not many tribes there relative to the West. So I would just state that we have a legal right to this, whether or not policymakers like it. That's irrelevant. We have a legal right to it, and we need policymakers and elected officials that are more respectful of law.
No, I think.
make a statement.
Okay. I think you should.
I'll take a stab at that one. I'll repeat the question. Basically, she works at a hospital in a remote location in Alaska, and the benefit of the healthcare services are predominantly employing local people, but not necessarily delivering better healthcare services and better health outcomes. Is that a fair summary, basically? For those who don't know, actually, there's two very unique areas of the Indian Health Service. One is Alaska, and the other is California, in which Margot Kerrigan is the California Area Indian Health Service Director. But the IHS has been under total 638 contracts and compacts in both Alaska area and California area. And in Alaska, there's over 200 tribes and villages. In California, there's over 100 tribes and villages. And it's under complete tribal control. So those are very unique areas. And I think that what you're talking about makes a lot of sense in terms of we can't equate the provision of healthcare services to health status. And that's really kind of the public health component of it. IHS is supposed to be doing more public health and primary prevention, but it comes down to a lack of services. What essential medical service do we cut so we can provide more public health services? And that's essentially the choice that we're faced with. We don't have nearly enough resources to meet the medical needs, let alone the public health needs. Now, ideally, we'd be investing a lot more in public health across the nation, and that would be the more cost-effective approach. But again, it's a market-driven health system that we deal with. So I agree, we can't equate provision of healthcare services to health status, and we see that in Indian country. But at the same time, I think our secondary prevention and tertiary prevention is not nearly as good as it needs to be because we can't manage chronic diseases with lack of resources as well. So it's across the board. And I think what you're talking about is really the need for more investment in public health services and primary prevention activities. But it comes down to resources, that's the bottom line.
There's a question in the back, and then up here after.
Visible. This is another degree of invisibility, like to the point that there are still school boards and places that we would approach that said, there are no Indians here when there's a thriving tribal center and government a mile down the road. So a question for Dr. Gonzalez would be, I'm curious if people, if this was on the measure, whether my hypothesis would be people that self-reported claims are more traditional, more connected to their language, maybe less fluent in English, dress more traditional, just feel that, I noticed you had one measure of discrimination was use of traditional medicine, but did you get a sense of that as a whole other measure of where people are going to face more discrimination if they are more traditional in all ways of that?
In my survey, I actually, I wanted to measure traditionalism, but the scales available to measure that are, well, we just need some better scales, I think, for that. So what you're referring to is women did indicate that a reason for the discrimination was based on their traditional use of medicine. It was the lowest reported reason for the discrimination. What really seemed to be prevalent was this idea around stereotypes for drug use and drug-seeking behavior, and that might be a complexity within that is contributed to the ways that Indian Health Service deals with providing care to individuals who need pain medication, because lots of the programs in the Northwest don't provide pain medication. So I think that there's more work being done around providers' implicit attitudes around traditionalism, stereotypes they may have for American Indians regarding individuals who are more traditional and less traditional. And a colleague of mine has just finished some work in this, and some of her preliminary research is showing that there is stereotype, a difference in attitudes in regards to how providers perceive sort of compliance or even interact or have expectations of their American Indian patients, whether or not they look more traditional or are more traditional versus those who look less traditional or who are less traditional. It's definitely an area that needs further exploring.
Can I jump in with that comment? I'm glad you bring up this issue of the North Carolina population. I think it kind of connects with Kelly's last comment. What I think is so interesting when we talk about traditionalism, especially when we consider places like North Carolina, which has a very unique history, and we're talking about populations that are mixed race, and oftentimes we don't really acknowledge the elephant in the middle of the room, but in North Carolina, it's mixed race with African American. And so we have to acknowledge, you know, the profound impact that ideologies around race can, how it continues to operate, especially in those places, but I imagine as well in places like Albuquerque. But what I think is interesting with these measures of traditionalism is I wonder, and I don't know, Kelly, maybe this is a question to you. You talk about, or you suggested people who appear traditional, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, what does that mean? Are we mm-hmm. talking about, you know, ethnic ornamentation? Or are we talking
right.
about, you know, racial, you know, kind of characteristics? I don't know. I just think, you know, we need to be really clear about this, because mm-hmm. I think, especially as it relates to traditionalism, is it a matter of attitude and orientation, or are we talking about something mm-hmm. entirely different, which is related to discrimination, mm-hmm. but forces us, I think, in some ways, especially those of us that do Native research, to consider internal racism, not mm-hmm. just racism as imposed from those outside, but kind of the internal racism among Native populations. And I think North Carolina is a great example. You know, because the other thing that you didn't mention is the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina is the largest federally recognized tribe, but they have a really interesting kind of recognition that they're recognized legally, but to the exclusion of certain benefits as a recognized tribe. And they're kind of in this catch-22, that they can't go through the acknowledgement process to be able to have access to those resources And you know, so they're kind of they're caught in this limbo, if you will, and then to be invisible in a kind of biracial context of the American South, I think is the same thing that we see happening in places like California. And Dina, you could probably speak to this, but you have a lot of California Indians who are invisible in kind of this biracial system of, you know, white and Latino or Hispanic. And I just think, you know, we need to talk about this, mm-hmm. you know. I don't think we can any longer afford to kind of couch it in polite language.
I think this calls for my other slide, which is, I think, a great cartoon of sort of implying the difficulties around defining what it means to be Indian and the stereotypes around the definition of Indian. So there was a question up here in front, and then Carrie will get you next. Hi.
If you didn't hear the question, it was basically what is being done in terms of education and what are the kind of American Indian attitudes toward education, really focusing on leadership development and trying to convey our message in a better way, I think. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that there's a huge spectrum of belief systems and cultures within the American Indian population. So there truly isn't an American Indian culture. There are American Indian cultures, and actually hundreds of them. And the circumstances in which American Indian people live are vastly different. If you compare some of the smaller tribes that are located close to urban centers with large casinos, that's a very different lifestyle than Pine Ridge. You know, they're very different worlds. So there's a spectrum of ultra poor and ultra wealthy. And you know, there's just a whole spectrum of experiences and educational opportunities as a result. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is that impoverished communities tend to have lower quality educational systems, and richer communities have better educational systems. It's a huge disparity. And what we see is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And when we talk about things like leadership development and educational opportunities, for so many of our people, they don't view those things as real opportunities. And just in my experience, I was fortunate that we moved away from the reservation when I was in grade school, because if I had stayed at Pine Ridge, I probably wouldn't be sitting here right now. I probably wouldn't have gone to college, let alone medical school or public health school. And I think about how much potential has been lost just from a lack of opportunity. And I think that, again, in our political environment right now, we're looking at even more cuts to social programs that could benefit populations that need those programs the most. At the same time, we're proposing more tax cuts for the ultra wealthy. It's remarkable that this is happening in this nation. But I think that our outlook is going to be more challenging in the years to come. And from my own experience, you know, growing up, I knew it wasn't illegal for an Indian to become a doctor, but it didn't seem attainable until I met one. And it wasn't until I was in college that I actually met an American Indian physician. And I think that if you grow up in the majority society and all of your teachers, all of your principals, all the doctors you've seen are from your race or ethnicity, then anything seems possible. But if you never see your own people in those positions, it doesn't really seem possible. So we have great challenges in that arena.
Can I jump in and say something as well that, you know, I think it's important to also think, I mean, we talk about education, I assume you mean formal education, but I'm wondering if it might be helpful if we think about developing, you know, human capital, you know, capacity within our community, so that maybe we can consider it more broadly, so not just formalized education, but really kind of developing that human capital within our communities, which education can come from a variety of different sources. So it's not just, you know, the well-educated, you know, returnee kind of prodigal child returns, but really to kind of develop what already exists within our communities, because I do think that there's tremendous strength that, you know, just the fact of endurance, you know, that I think that it hasn't been realized and it hasn't really been tapped. And I don't know that going away to college is always necessarily the solution. I just think that we need to kind of think a little bit creatively about, you know, education or human capital, if you will.
And I'd also like to add to that, real briefly, based on my experience, the most important thing for me to be successful in college and since graduating from school with a PhD are the mentors that have crossed my path. I'm the first person in my family to go to any college, and I completed a PhD this last spring. And I have to say, my family, they supported me in what I was doing, but they really wanted to know, when are you going to get a job and when are you going to get married? I'm still not. Carrie.
Actually, that's to me, no, because you can't cut IHS funding for any service unit based on other third-party revenue. You can't do that. And to me, it's actually a good thing that that's happening, because that's even one step above self-determination and self-governance and self-insurance. And for those tribes who can afford it, why not? You know, I think that's a good thing. And in truth, I think we need to, as tribes, we need to look at medicine as an industry, and we need to participate in it as an industry. And are there groups that make money in healthcare? You bet there are. We can participate in that, but the only way to do that is through self-determination. Of course, most of our impoverished areas just don't have the capacity to do that based on lack of resources. But if you look at IHS Direct Services, I think historically we've looked at healthcare as a service the government provides for us. But we should be looking at it as an industry, because then there's 638 contracting, 638 compacting, and ultimately self-insurance. And to me, that's true self-governance and self-determination in healthcare. So for those who can afford to do it, more power to them.
I would like to add to that that by accessing healthcare outside of the Indian healthcare system may add a level of complexity for the patient to navigate through those systems on top of the complexities that they've already encountered within the Indian healthcare system. So it would be of our best interest, I think, to consider some of those, some ways to provide a supportive navigating system for American Indians who are accessing healthcare outside of Indian Health Service. Okay, I think we're done. Oh, okay, one more. This is. Thank you.
And I think that historically repeat the question. what can we do to address the underfunding of Indian Health Service, I think is the main gist of the comment.
Right.
And I think that historically we've worked a lot with National Indian Health Board and National Congress of American Indians, and those are the largest tribal organizations to address these issues, and that's the venue we need to work in. But again, we only have federally recognized tribes in 35 states. And even with all of the other federally recognized tribes with a single voice, it's still not enough political clout. We need to be partnering with American Cancer Society, American Public Health Association, the American Medical Association, because these are truly social justice issues that are not just, to me, it's not just an Indian issue. It's an American, a United States social justice issue. And there should be plenty of people who are non-Indian who recognize this as a social justice and civil rights issue. And we need to be partnering with non-Indian organizations that have more political clout than we do. So that's the venue that we're starting to pursue.
Thank you, everyone, for your time.